Tonight's about the world behind the world, which, if you're not familiar with the concept, all the old cultures and all even new cultures, if they have a sense of creative imagination, eventually hit the idea that what most people call the world is really the front of the world. It's the measurable, weighable, what they call the statistical world, the knock on wood, you know, this is the fact of the matter world. And it's a necessary thing. If there wasn't such a world, we wouldn't get to be here, because we actually enter that world and become part of the measurement and the weight of things. But besides the obvious, there's the hidden qualities of creation. And the old understanding was everything that appears in this world is really generated from the world behind the world, and the world behind the world is the world of eternal things. It's the world where creation is ongoing and continuing. The same way, no one has any time anymore in this world. We're running out of time rapidly. At least that's the feeling everybody has. There's not enough time to do everything that a person has to do. But time itself is an eruption out of the eternal, which is behind the world. And when people are running out of time, it's not a day timer that we need. It's contact with eternity. All time, just like all matter, is an eruption out of the eternal background. Each of us are too. And so the book is about this double dynamic, the two great stories. One is the eternal drama of the world. And I'm saying that it's eternal, that what happens is the world seems to end and it comes back. The book is full of what I call recreation stories, stories of how the world keeps recreating itself from its own disasters, just as most people really do. And that's the second great story, is the endless number of unique stories being lived by individual human beings within time, which is nestled in the front edge of eternity. And so, to me, and to most mythological perspectives, the two stories are both necessary, and just like the two worlds are. And those two stories, the great drama of the cosmos and the unique, strange story of each individual, are the two things necessary for the world to continue along. So I'm going against this contemporary idea that recognizes that humans are capable of seemingly destroying the world, and that leads some people to think, well, maybe we don't need people. I mean, maybe people have come to the end of their usefulness in this kind of world, but yet the old tradition says that's not the case, that the unique, never-to-be-lived-again story of each individual is part of the ongoing creation, and that our job, especially when things get confusing and dark, is to stay in touch with these two stories, our own individual, never-to-be-lived-by-anybody-else story, and the great story of the cosmos. And so I'm approaching that by looking at the two worlds, but I'm also looking at the two stories. So in cultures that keep the imagination of the other world, the world behind the world, that's where you find that cultures have a great interest in the ancestors. Because in the world of measurement and kind of facts, you come to the end of your life and it's all over. You know, they have that little piece of concrete or, you know, whatever, marble if you can afford it, or someone can afford it, and they stick it in the ground and that's it. It's all over, over and done. And yet everybody knows it's not really over, because the soul continues on, because the soul can exist without the body. It did before it picked up the body. So when it drops the body, it goes on. The modern world, since they can't measure it, they think it doesn't exist. But all other cultures, understood that the soul goes somewhere at the end of life, and so they therefore developed an interest in the ancestral realm. And the idea is that the souls of the ancestors, who are simply the ones that went before us, their souls become interested in us. The reason being is we're the ones with the bodies now. And apparently after you lose your body, you actually have a rather sharp affection for it, even if you didn't like it when you had it. You know what I'm saying? Finally, people accept their bodies. A little bit too late. But it leaves them, you know, sharply interested in those who happen to have bodies. And so for most traditions, they say that the ancestors are actually trying to help us. One way they do it, according to certain mythologies, is they send us dreams, that the dreams are a conversation with the ancestors in the other world. And they're giving us distinct information. The problem is they can only give us information in language that's familiar to us. Therefore, you find very strange images in your own dreams, and even friends from, you know, grade school suddenly come into your dream because it's the only one that can deliver a certain message from the other world, I call it. You can call it the other side. Thank you for singing. It's all downhill after that, you know. It's one of the essential things about humans is the capacity to speak and sing. It's one of our ways of being natural. And I know it's common nowadays to think that humans are separate from nature. But when we are speaking, and poetry, it is the natural speech of the soul, when we're speaking and at least allowing for the possibility of a poetic phrasing or a poetic inspiration, and when we're singing, we are part of nature, just the way birds in the evening, when it begins to become dark and the light of creation is draining out of the world, they finish the day, they finish the brightness of the day with their song, and that's part of nature. And whenever we break into song, we're joining that nature too. And so one of the ways to heal the alienation of humanity from nature is to use our natural given gifts, that is to say the capacity for speech, which involves some form of consciousness and then song, which puts us in a harmony, in a harmony. And notice that the beginning of the word harmony is harm. That is to say, harmony comes after harm has been done. There's a strange relationship between harm or wounding or division that leads to harmony. So I said that poetry is the natural speech of the soul. It used to be considered that way. So a couple of poems to get us going in that direction. This is called It Has Not Rained Light. I just love this poem because it's talking about, up here where we have all this rain, but it has this new idea of raining light, suggesting this. Climate change, who knows? Maybe it could start raining light. It has not rained light for many days, and the wells in most eyes look drought-stricken. It's true also that friends are not easy to find in these barren places where almost everyone has become ill from fiercely guarding nothing. You get the notion? Whole big, weapon-laden, angst-ridden cultures fiercely guarding nothing, spending a heck of a lot of money to do it and wasting lives into the balance. So listen, on this primal caravan, careers and critics can appear real in the intense desert heat. But I say to anyone who would stay close to the world, don't get lost in them, for it has not rained light here for days. Look around and see most everyone is diseased from all this making love to nothing. So it's the job of the mystical poets to name the disease and then to start suggesting cures. They didn't go for the cure very much in there, but, it was a good diagnosis. And that's at least gets things started. So this is similar, going back to the idea of more than one world. And this is Rumi, and it's called Wean Yourself. In it, he's talking as if to an embryo, trying to give the embryo a sense of the outside world. Imagine when you're wrapped up, you know, inside the womb, and your eyes haven't really opened, and someone's saying, here's what's out there. And of course, the embryo can't believe that, because all it knows is the darkness of the womb with the occasional light, and then with the sense of the inner waters. That's all it knows. And so we're like that in relation to the world behind the world, you know, especially not we exactly ourselves. I know you are all far above that. But I mean the common in the daily world, you know, in the newspapers, they never mention the world behind the world, you know. I mean, I'm joking, but you know what I mean? This is the oldest understanding of life, and they never mention it. So there's an embryonic world called reality that is actually not real, that the real, capital R, is what's behind so-called reality. So this is Rumi playing with that notion. Little by little, wean yourself. This is the gist of what I have to say. From an embryo whose nourishment comes in blood, move to an infant drinking milk, and then to a child on solid food, and then to a searcher after real wisdom, and finally to a hunter of the more invisible game. Think how it is to have a conversation with an embryo. You might say, the world outside is vast and intricate. There are wheat fields and mountain passes, and there are orchards just coming into bloom. At night, there are millions of galaxies, and in the sunlight, the beauty of friends dancing at a wedding. You ask the embryo why he or she stays cooped up inside in the dark with their eyes closed, and listen to their answer. There is no other world. I only know what I've experienced, and you must be hallucinating. So unfortunately, we live in a time when if you have a notion about the greater world or the world behind the world or the world of creative imagination or the world of the soul or the world of the spirit, there's so many names for it because you can't actually name it. You can just point in the direction. If you have a notion about it, people will tell you you're hallucinating. You can't vote for it, you know. You can't blame it. You can't marry it. You can't divorce it. Therefore, you must be hallucinating. You get what I'm saying? And so it's difficult right now to be fully alive because life is considered to be such a diminished and narrow thing and is not understood in the modern world that each person is a microcosm of the great macrocosm, which is another word for the world behind the world. And so the general message being sent out through all of the endless numbers of media outlets that now exist is that each person is small and not worth much. Whereas from the ancient point of view, from the mythological point of view, and even from the cosmological point of view, each person is a microcosm of the great story, and each person in a given moment could be equal to the whole thing. So I find myself having to say these kind of things because I watch the world or the sense of the world diminishing. And so as I was partway through writing this book, behind everything, I'm trying to hawk this book, but that's because it talks about the world behind the world. It's valuable. Anyway, but partway through it, in the confusion of modern things, I wound up doing an interview for a book that wasn't written. This kind of thing happens to me. And so I didn't know when I was lying and when I wasn't, because I hadn't actually written the book. I had to answer the questions. Anyway, the best question that they asked was, why are you writing a book about the other world? And so I wanted to make two answers to that. One was the job of a mythologist to not exactly insist, but poetically claim that there's more to the world than can be measured. And then the second issue is the problem that exists for young people growing up into the world as it exists now. That is to say, young people have no defense against the world they enter. They can adopt poses and wear outfits and mark their bodies in order to say we don't quite like what's going on, but they cannot really defend themselves because they have to inhale the world that exists before them. It's the nature of the vulnerability of youth. And so youth are growing up into this severely threatened world, and they feel it all the way down inside themselves. And I felt the need to say something about, well, you'll see how it goes here. So the book begins with these issues. In the first chapter, I'm going to read a little bit. The first chapter is called Run Towards the Roar. Stories are the oldest school of humankind. Genuine stories offer a living school where the only entry requirements are an active imagination, a capacity to feel one's own feelings, and a willingness to approach the world as a place of mystery and revelation. Stories are the imaginal base of the world, a living literature that underlies and secretly unifies everything. People feel more whole while listening to stories and feel most lost when out of touch with their own story. Genuine stories don't prove anything. Rather, they reveal things that are there but are not being seen. For stories speak the many-minded speech of symbols that convey images and ideas at the same time in the little time it takes to tell a tale. The world, despite its disasters, tragedies, and villainies, can end unless it runs out of stories. For this world is made of stories. Was that Muriel Rukeyser, the poet, who said this world is not made of atoms, it's made of stories? For the world is made of stories, and each tale a part of an eternal drama unfolding from beginning to end and then over again. As long as all the stories don't come to an end at the same time, this world will continue. That's what I tell young people when they ask if this world will end soon. And increasingly, young people ask about the end of the world. For the past 3 or 4 years, I couldn't tell you how many times a young person has asked me, is this world going to end? Whether it be educated youth considering the dangers of global warming and climate change, less privileged ones feeling the bite of poverty and the growing disparity between the rich and the poor, or those exposed to the increased threats of violence and extremism, modern youth grow up amidst threats of natural disaster and nightmares of terrorism and can't help but doubt the future of the world. Typically, youth carry the unfolding dream of life. So it's startling to hear young people wondering whether this world will wait for them to find their place in it. When the end feels near, everyone feels old, and even the young become older than they should be. What I'm trying to say there is young people are not young now. No one's really young now. But young people are not as young as they used to be even when I was young. I don't know if you get my meaning. They have an edge of oldness. They have dreams that don't fully break into existence. You can see it in sociology because they wait longer to marry, longer to pick a career, because something is not engaging fully, because the world that's being described and offered to them is not a world of great promise and potential. It's a diminished world, and that makes them feel a little bit older. In a sense, we're at the end of time, not really the end. I call it the ends, plural, of time, a time when many things end. And that makes everybody feel a little bit more battered and a little bit older, including young people. When the end seems near, everyone can feel old, and even the young become older than they should be. So what story are we in when those carrying the dream of life find themselves closest to the doors of death? In this world, life and death both roar at the frailty of the individual soul, and it's easy to become prey to either of those. As fears about the world accumulate and terrors abound, I often recall an old African teaching about fear. On the ancient savannas, life pours forth in the form of teeming, feeding herds, and nearby lions wait in anticipation of the hunt. The pack of lions sends the oldest, weakest member of the pride away from the hunting pack. Having lost most of its teeth, its roar is far greater than its ability to bite. The old one goes off and settles in the grass across from where the hungry lions wait. And as the herds enter the area between the hunting pack and the old lion, it begins to roar mightily. And upon hearing the fearful roar, most of the herd turns and runs away from the source of roaring and the fear that they feel, and they run wildly in the opposite direction. And of course, they run right to where the strongest lions wait in a group for dinner to arrive in the tall grass. You get the idea? Run towards the roar, the old people used to tell the young ones. When faced with great danger, run towards the roaring, for there you will find some safety and a way through. The threat of the end of the world being near can be viewed as an old lion that has roared many times before. People have always feared the end. Fear of the end of the world has been there from the very beginning of it. The end has been repeatedly predicted and religiously expected, yet it has never arrived. Sometimes the greatest safety comes from going to where the fear seems to originate, and facing the end may be the best way of beginning again. Amidst the roaring of this threatened and troubled world, surprising ways to begin it all again may be found if we're not stopped by the fear and if we run towards the roar. So you get this little idea? This is what I'm telling young people, asking, is the world going to end? And I'm kind of suggesting, let's look at the end of the world. Let's look at what it means to end. And then I often begin to tell stories about how things end and begin. And what they're saying when they say run towards the roar is that by going in the direction where fear comes from, we will find a way through. The word fear comes from the old Anglo-Saxon fair, F-A-R-E, as in thoroughfare. And fear doesn't mean to stop and tremble. Fear means to go through it. In other words, what we fear is what we will go through, and what we're going to go through now is the end of the world, or as they say, the end of the world as we know it. And in order to go through it, we have to go towards it. In other words, start accepting that the certain things about the world that have been taken for granted are coming towards their end. And I feel a necessity, a responsibility to say this to young people, because they're supposed to survive the rest of us that are older. But in the course of saying it, I realize I'm talking to the eternal youth that's inside of every person, regardless of their age. Do you get what I'm saying? It's also for the elders to understand that we have to move towards the roar. I mean, that's the underlying issue in the current campaign, you know, for the presidency, is change. And it's not simple change. It's radical change to understand we are in a different place, and we're trying to get to a new creative sense of this world that brings nature and culture back into some kind of alignment with each other, because we're facing those two great dangers, global warming and global terror. And it's not an accident. This is what happens when the end starts roaring at people and saying it's time for a huge change. So on one hand, we're in this great sense of opportunity, where those that are alive now have the opportunity to pick amongst the things that are ending and find the threads of beginning again. On the other hand, to be alive at this kind of time means to be plagued with certain kinds of anxiety and sudden depressions and things. You know what I'm saying? Depression is the most popular symptom in modern culture. I'm joking when I say popular, but you know, in a certain way, people pick their poisons. And so depression is something that grows greater when people don't feel connected to the vitality of life. And as you notice in political things, people keep using fear to keep people from understanding what they really need. And so there's another situation where running towards the roar politically is very helpful, is to not get caught up in the fear and think that we're not here to live a full life. It's not security that we're after. That's one of the big problems with Social Security. You know, there's only two problems with Social Security. First of all, it's not social. And second of all, it doesn't offer security. Other than that, it's a very good program. They should just call it social insecurity, and it would be accurate. So what I'm doing then throughout the book is trying to offer a kind of mythic takes on the situation we're in. And on the way to a story, just a few more notes. This is from a section called Mythic Inoculation. And the idea is that if we could get inoculated with enough mythic perspective, then we could survive the diseases of the era. After talking about the raw, I start to say in the book here, if you run away from the raw, like the herd animals do, you wind up running to the pack of lions waiting to devour everybody, and I refer to them as the isms. That is to say, literalism, fundamentalism, scientism, saviorism, and all those isms are the lion pack waiting for anybody who's not willing to go towards the roar. You get my sense of things? The biggest disease of the modern culture is literalism. Taking things as they seem to be and being proud of it. You know? You notice everybody starts their arguments with the facts of the matter are. I haven't been interested in the facts of the matter since my 13th birthday. On the night of my 13th birthday, I read my first myths and realized the facts of the matter were limited in their intrigue. You get what I'm saying? Sometimes you need the facts. The facts are very helpful, but the facts never tell the whole story. And that's why when someone says, you know, the fact of the matter is, they're already lying. That's the fact of that matter. So this is part of the mythic inoculation. Although decidedly frail, perpetually foolish, and seemingly about to destroy the whole thing, humans are blessed with an imagination equal to the world and essential to its ways of continuing. I'm trying to put humans back into the center of the ongoing creation of the world, which was one of the jobs of mythology. In the great drama of life, the human soul becomes the make weight, the extra quantity and uniquely living quality needed to help tip the balance of the world towards the continuing of creation. Humans are in the balance point. That's why we could destroy the world, but we could also lend our own being and sense of things to the ongoing creation. That's the tension of now. That's the underlying source of the anxiety, is that we are now on the dime. Either we're adding to creation or we're adding to destruction. There's no more middle ground. The gravitas of the awakened soul helps tie the thread of the eternal to the presence of the present moment. When the dark times come around and the end seems near again, it becomes more essential for the individual person to learn and live the story that the soul carries from before birth. If people are not invited into the stream of culture, then tragedies begin to grow, and unlived dreams become tragedies waiting to happen. Lose the sense that each life carries meaning, and death will become meaningless as well. What I'm trying to say in one sentence is, when life has no more meaning, and a lot of people think it's just about security and safety, and that is not life. Life requires proper risks. Safety is only found when we take the risks that our souls want to take. And when people settle for a life that doesn't have meaning, they will wind up with a death that is meaningless. That's serious business. You can feel it, because then you don't get to go visit the ancestors. You know, you have to go through the cycle, the kind of spin cycle of eternity, and you get spitted back out, and you come back as a one-legged frog or something. You know, and you have to limp around, and it takes a long time to get back. Traditionally, it has been the function of myth to wrap people in stories that make intuitive sense of this world. Not logical sense, not academic sense. It's fine if you have the time. Mythology is about an intuitive grasp of the world as it is and our place in it. Traditionally, that's the function of myth, to point to meaningful ways of being part of existence. Yet under the harsh rule of materialism and the dull spell of literalism, myth becomes dismissed as fantasy, as something out of touch with reality. Yet in the inner recesses of the human soul, where the facts of life mingle with the mysteries of eternity, myth means emergent truth. The old meaning of myth is emergent truth. The myth in us is the truth trying to live its way into the world. And the real truths of the human soul don't exist until they are lived. They can't be just thought about. They have to be lived into the world. In the long run, and it's the long run that's of increasing concern, myth makes meaning. The job of myth is to make the world meaningful and to hold everyone in the mythic imagination of a living story. Meaning is a storied thing, and many meanings appear and can become clear once the storyline of the occasion has been found. Each life, each myth has its own inner logic, its own subjective truth, and its own persuasive beauty within its dramatic form. So I'm trying to suggest in this mythic inoculation that part of the job of a person is to find the storyline that's in our life. And we're here just for a few hours and we don't have really the time to do it. But in a critical moment, a person can stop in their life and look back. And if you look back and try to clear the ground behind you and knock away anything that isn't essential, you know, it probably turns out not to be essential that you got an A or failed, you know, I don't know what it was, grammar or arithmetic. For some people it might be, for most not. You get rid of that stuff. What remains there that cannot be removed, for were it to be removed, you would be gone. Those are the things that make up the storyline of a person. Does it make sense? Usually a person, if they're serious and reflective, can find moments, particularly certain times in childhood, again in early youth, and then later in the mid-20s and so on, these critical moments, the moment we fell in love and found out that we were able to love, and not only that, we're slightly lovable. Those moments are incredibly important. They make us who we are. The critical occasions in our life begin when reflected upon to reveal the storyline that is trying to live through us. That's part of what I'm trying to suggest. And when the world around us rattles, whether it be climate change or cultural disaster, whatever happens to be going on, instead of running towards the isms that offer false security, it's better to drop into the story already happening in the soul. Last night we were up in Seattle doing an event up there, and a man came up. I didn't recognize him at all, and it turned out that I knew him over 20 years ago when he was quite a bit younger. He looks like a different person. And he said, you know, it's really odd for me. He said, because I talked to you over 20 years ago, and at that time there were these worries about the world being destroyed by nuclear weapons. He said, and I come up and asked you about it, and what you said to me was, if the world's going to end, you want to be living your life fully. If the world is not going to end, you want to be living your life fully. He said, and every time I've been scared in the last 20 years, I repeat that to myself. I thought that was quite amazing. It made me realize I was writing this book 20 years ago. So the idea is to do two things I'm suggesting in the midst of what's going to be a long period of confusion. James Joyce called it the chaosmos, the mixture of cosmos and chaos. And some people call it the apocalypse, but remember, apocalypse comes from the Greek apokalein, and it doesn't mean big fiery end. It means lifting of the veil. And when the veil lifts, some things are uncovered and exposed and become raw, and other things are discovered. So that we're in the time where things become uncovered and torn apart, and we're also in the time when hidden things become discovered, and those discoveries are what are used to make the world or assist creation to go on. So the big story, and then within that, the little story. Those are the two ways I'm suggesting to maintain some sense of vitality and stability, avoid some of the anxiety and the great holes of depression by keeping threaded to those two things. Does it make some sense? Yeah? Usually what's missing are those two things. The big story, you know, is gone missing for a long time, really. And it doesn't turn out to be in the religious stories because they get reduced to literal belief systems. And the big stories cannot be reduced. They stay vital. And then the other thing that gets lost is one's own storyline, because most of the neighbors are not assisting. In other words, most people think they're living an outer life and lose the inner threads. It's very hard to be oneself in a culture that doesn't know that each person is already themselves. So I'd like to tell a story that addresses both. Are you ready for a story? So this is a story that kind of leapt into the book, a little bit to my surprise, because it wasn't part of the original plan, which of course made me more fond of it than many of the others. the beginning, there was nothing but the endless expanse of the primal ocean. Nothing else existed. Nothing broke the spell of silence that was there at the very beginning. And then the sound began that still resonates through the world, that still murmurs and still whispers throughout the world each day and each night. And the sound began when those first thinkers, when those original beings began to ponder on the situation and began to speak into the world the sounds of existence. And some say they were named Heart of Heaven and Heart of Earth and Sudden Lightning and Hurricane and Heart of the Sky. Some say those were the thinkers at the beginning, pondering the sounds that were needed to make the world come into existence, the sounds that still murmur and still whisper at the back of the world today. Other people say it wasn't a whole group like that. It was a single one that spoke the original sound. One or many, I don't know. I'm willing to accept both. For something had to start this thing, and something had to speak the sound of existence. And so, once the words of creation, the sounds of making, entered the world, all kinds of things began to take shape and take form. The sky was separated from the waters. In the midst appeared the earth with its solidity. Pretty soon, mountains appeared on the earth, and then forest appeared. And soon enough, there were animals running in and out of the forest. And life was beginning to teem and was beginning to sing the song of creation. It was a great thing. And after it happened, those original makers, those original ponderers and thinkers were quite satisfied at the sound, at the beauty, at the explosion, at the existence of life. Well, except for Heart of Heaven. Heart of Heaven thought something was missing, and he listened carefully to see what sounds and what expressions were in the world. And it came to Heart of Heaven that there was something missing, and what was missing was awareness, a kind of consciousness that could express a gratitude for the gift of life. For although the birds could sing with beauty, and the animals could growl and grunt, and many other sounds entered the world, none of them had the awareness of gratitude, and none of them expressed back to the creators a conscious recognition of the gift of life. And so, Heart of Heaven decided to make some conscious beings. And seeing that the earth and the mud, the earth when it was mixed with water becoming mud, was quite pliable, Heart of Heaven took some mud and began to shape some people out of mud. He shaped them up and looked at them, and they were kind of cute, standing there in their mud bodies on the earth, looking up at the sky. And Heart of Heaven thought, this has potential, this has possibilities. But then, maybe it was in the northwest, I don't know, but then the rain came. And as soon as the rain came, all those mud people melted right back down to the earth, and you could barely see a trace of them. And so, Heart of Heaven pondered on the situation and then decided to make another kind of people and took wood and hollow reeds and began to make beings out of that, kind of like wood people. And those people had a kind of verticality. They could stand up, and actually they could do things. And pretty soon, after being fashioned, they began to make things themselves. And after a while, those wood people had their own technology and their own utensils, and they were quite busy making all kinds of things. But Heart of Heaven was waiting for the expression of gratitude for the gift of life, and it was not forthcoming, for it turned out that those wood people had no hearts. And not only that, they were a little hard-headed. Soon enough, it seemed that the animals figured the same thing out, and the animals began to turn against the wood people, and after a while, their own technologies turned against them as well, and pretty soon the whole thing was in a big mess, and that's when Heart of Heaven decided to bring a black rain down on the earth. And when that black rain came, it destroyed all those wood people, who some people called the doll people. And they say there was nothing left of them. And if there was something left, well, then those became monkeys. After a while, part of heaven decided to try again. You know how it is in this world. The third time is often a charm. And so part of heaven decided to make another kind of people out of maize, out of corn. And heart of heaven took that corn and shaped people out of the flower of corn, out of the maize of corn that grows up vertical, like songs reaching for the sun. And heart of heaven made corn people. And those corn people were elegant. And those corn people had great vision, unlike the others. They could see beyond themselves. They could see beyond their own circumstances, see past their own condition. And not only that, they could see far enough into the world. In other words, they had insight, enough insight to know that life was a gift. And so they expressed immediately back to whoever had created the world gratitude for the gift of life. And when Heart of Heaven heard that expression, he knew that now the world was complete. Pretty good, huh? Maybe we should stop right there. You know what I mean? The third time is a charm, and the third kind of people are like sweet and elegant, you know, and they stand up and they express gratitude. But the story went on, for it happened as those third kind of people, as those corn people began to see so many things in the world, it was recognized by the other gods that the corn people could see as well as the gods could see. And therefore, those gods became envious, and they went to Heart of Heaven and say, look what you've done now. You've created beings that see like we do. You've created beings that know in the way we do. We don't like this. And so they prevailed upon Heart of Heaven that he should take away the far-seeing sight of the corn people. And for some reason, Heart of Heaven agreed, and Heart of Heaven took the great sight and the deep insight away from the corn people. And then Heart of Heaven said, you know, what's put into existence can never completely be taken away. And so Heart of Heaven made a dispensation under which the corn people would have a way to recapture their great sight that allowed them to see into things and allowed them to see far into the future and allowed them to know the way the creators know. Heart of Heaven gave them a way of finding the sight again. And it was a way of using stories, a way of finding what was called the council book, the book of stories, saying that if the people, the corn people, needed to see again, they could find their way back and they could see the way the gods see by entering the flow of stories that were there right from the beginning when creation began with the sound of making. The way it still echoes in the world, the way it still whispers in the mind, the way it still murmurs in the blood, that thing that started back then, still ongoing, the sound of creation going through each of us, going through each thing in the world. At least that's what they say when they tell these old stories. And me, I'm just trying to do my job and keep the stories alive and maybe find a way to bump into that collection of stories that allows people to begin to see again. The human heart is the organ at issue in the current dilemmas, just as it was at the beginning. The heart is a subtle organ that remains connected to the Heart of Heaven and also to the heart of earth. The inner eyes see everything metaphorically, so we call a certain person lion-hearted, another is eagle-eyed, a third has a stomach like an ox. In the strange weaving together of human organs with animal intensities, people capture things that are there yet cannot be proven. Humans are half animal and half other. The other part can be godlike, or else it can act worse than any animal. Humans are required to bear the presence of inhuman things and experience the extremes of being. You see what I'm trying to put humans? We call someone acting like an animal, but we're actually acting lower than an animal. Animals are ethical all the time. Animals are doing animal things. They do what they're supposed to do. We fall way below that understanding, and yet we can rise way above it. We're in this huge tension of opposites. We're the make-weights, the place where creation loses and finds its vision. That's what all the old stories say. It's quite exciting, except it tears you apart a lot. Some argue that the heart and the eye are separate organs that shouldn't be confused. One receives impressions of light and movement, and the other, deeply encased in the body, is there to pump blood. Yet there are organs within organs. The mind can be anywhere in the body. A blind person can see many things clearly. The heart can see, and it has its own sense of purpose and direction. It has its own thoughts that began long before the mud body formed and all the kicking and crying started. The heart's eye was open before birth. It saw otherworldly things and seeks to perceive them again. The pain of birth closed that eye, yet it expects to open again in the course of life. Trying to see that way again requires that the heart crack wider open, and that brings back the original pain of separation from the divine. Many try to avoid that heartbreaking pain, yet the eye of the heart can only see through the cracks into this world. It used to be better known that the only heart worth having was a broken heart, for only then can others find a way in, and only then can people develop insight into their own wounding and its healing. The heart becomes embattled within long before the heart attack arrives. A doctor who doesn't know the subtleties of that organ within the organ is simply a surgeon of the obvious. He may be doing emergency work, but the pathways of real healing will remain obstructed. The human heart is a great inner territory that participates in creation and that makes mistakes, yet can learn to forgive itself and forgive others as well. If the heart doesn't open to its own vision and learn the meaning already hidden within it, it can become a weapon that battles with all of creation. Many things can close and harden the heart. Extremes of poverty can dry the heart and turn it bitter. Sound like Barack Obama. Isn't that funny? When I heard him, you know this thing he said about people being bitter in Pennsylvania, and they jumped all over him for it. And then I realized, oh, I wrote that in the book. Guy might be right. Too much rejection can cause a person to reject their own inner vision. You hear what I'm saying? If we're not embraced by the parents, if we're not embraced by the community, if for some reason we get heavily rejected and feel some kind of damage to the core of the self, then we go against our own vision and we begin to work against our own kind of growth. Violation of the subtle tissues of the heart can turn it towards violence. I work with the violent youth a lot, and I can tell you, at least my own experience, everyone that turns violence has already had violence done to them. That's why they became violent. You know what I'm saying? And in order to help them find their own heart and a way to see them their way through the world, you have to work with the violence that happened to them. You can't simply punish them for being violent. At least that's the way I see it. Too much sorrow also makes a stone of the heart. One more thing here. In the end, the human soul tries to become ancient again. And being ancient means to have the courage of the beginnings as well as the wisdom of survival. Not the simple survival of the fittest, but an awakening of surprising visions that don't fit into the literal ways of seeing. The eloquence of creation and meaningful imagination waits to be found where it always resides, in the heart within the heart, in the living stories that reconnect to the mind, to the heart, and open the vision towards the future. So I'm just trying to open up and pull the story along and suggest that we are in that place now where we have to find ways to see a future that's different and bigger, that's wider and deeper, that has more gratitude in it, that has more consciousness in it, that has more awareness of our own place in the middle, in the make-weights in this system. At the end of the book, I'm trying to figure out how to close the book, and I remembered this Irish myth where they talk about how the center, well, as the book is proceeding, I'm working my way towards the center. And interesting you mentioned Eden, because at the center of Eden was not the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. At the center of Eden was the tree of the tree of life. The tree of knowledge of good and evil is, I call it like a beginner's tree. Like when you're entering the world and you need to go to work, the first thing we learn is how to divide things, how to separate things. That's the beginning of knowledge. But the deep knowledge is how to unify things. And the tree of life was called the tree of unity, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil was called the tree of division. And you start out by entering the divided world, and then you work towards unity. And in a sense, everything is trying to get back to the tree of life. We're trying to recapture the sense of paradise, which requires a tree at the middle, a tree that unifies everything. And connected to that is the old idea, or the old definition of evil, because it's such a big thing in the world now, where everybody wants to put evil onto other people. But the old definition was unripe. Evil means it's unripe. And so I like the idea of ripened fruit on the tree of life, in the center of things, that pulls everything back together. So it was interesting, after the book gets, you know, written out, and then it gets printed, and then just casually, I wanted to see what's right in the middle of the book, because I'm a storyteller, and stories are made of beginning, middle, and end. I know where it began. I was already reading that to you about Run Towards the Raw. I'm about to tell you where it ends, and I wanted to see what was in the middle, and in the very middle of the book is the Tree of Life, accidentally on purpose. You get what I'm saying? Because I write it out with a pen, and then I put it into my computer, but the printer does something different, and it turns out the middle of the book is the Tree of Life, and I'm going like, that's cool. You know, like that's, you know, thank you. You know, gratitude for the gift of life. So in the middle of the book is the Tree of Life, and a couple of chapters on one I call The Weighted Away, How to Find the Great Way Again. And the great way leads to the tree of life. And I think we're in this struggle now where everything is so divided. You know what I'm saying? The election is divided like 47, 49, or whatever it is. Whatever issue you come up with, what do they call that? When people try to come into the country and they don't want them here? They used to call it immigration. Now they call it illegal aliens. That's right. Remember the immigrants? That was like us. But since, like, we're now the ones here and we don't want any more like us, they're illegal aliens. Anyway, you throw that out and they vote 50-50 and all this kind of stuff. Everything gets divided. And so the hardest thing to find is unity. Unity requires real vision. Vision requires that the heart open and the mind become clear. That's the big struggle, you know, that we're in. So I try to address that throughout the middle of the book. And then you have to end the book somewhere. So I was thinking of this Irish myth. And so they say the center, because in Ireland, there's actually a stone at the center. And they know that the center sometimes breaks apart. And they say when the center cannot hold, remember Yeats' great poem, when the center cannot hold, it can't disappear. It's like in the story from the Pope of Vaux, where there's a dispensation. That which was created into the world can never completely disappear. It goes somewhere else. When the center disappears, the many parts of it go out to the edges of the world. So if we want to reconstitute the center, which means the place of unity, what we have to do is find all the pieces that used to be the center that are at the edge. Now, what are the edges of the world? To me, the edges of the world are the places of rejection, the places of exile and alienation. And if you go to the edges, what you find is people that are in violence, people that are in prison, people that are sick, people that are in hospice, people that are in depression, people that are lost, people that are emotionally disturbed. You know what I'm saying? Those are all the edge people in the edge places. And so what they say in Ireland is when the center falls apart, each person goes to the edge where it looks darkest to them. In other words, go towards the roar of darkness where you wouldn't want to go, but go there. And if each person goes there, then each person can learn something about their own self and develop their own vision and pick up a thread of meaning. And then if each person turns back and brings their own thread of meaning back, then the center is reconstructed and remade from each person's thread of knowledge. And that way, no one person has to become heroic and solve the whole thing. No one religion can claim to do it, and no political people can pretend to do it. Do you get what I'm saying? So that's how I wind up ending the book, with the idea that the individual threads of our lives and the story through which we find a meaningful vision is our way of contributing to the remaking of the center. And in a certain sense, the book ends with the idea that the great cosmological story is recreated through the threads of the individual story. I can't see how else it's going to happen. I'm old enough to know that when people say they're going to save the world, they're really going to make it worse. You know what I mean? I don't know about you, I've been there. And so all the stories of saviorism wind up damaging things. There's a whole other thing to go. Or as they used to say, remember you enter the great oracle of Delphi and over the door it says, know thyself. Because you can get a great oracle, but if you don't know who you are, you don't know how it relates to you. And so for the first job of people is to know our own self. And I'm saying one way to understand that is to know our own story and then be busy about learning how to live that in a very full way. So one more little tale. You have to put a, well, I have to put a picture on the front of the book because I like images a lot. So on the front of the book is Vishnu. Vishnu, the god who dreams up the world, the blue-skinned god, only he's arising from this fish. And it's a story called Manu and the Fish. And there's a series of stories in there where I'm trying to reclaim what I call folk myth characters like Manu and Jonah and Noah and so on. Because now they're considered to be kind of adherents of religious belief. But before that, they were characters in folk stories. And I kind of want to claim them back because they're really the inheritance of humanity, not the adherence of religion. And so Noah, it turns out, is a fairly recent flood story. There's much older ones, and one of them is Manu. Manu, this is a story in the Hindu mythology, and Manu means like man. It's like the prototype, the first human. And Manu was walking around by a shore, and there was an ocean there, and a little fish jumped up out of the ocean and said, would you please save me because the big fish are about to eat me. So now Manu, mankind, has a choice to make. Does he bend down and pick up the fish and kind of save it from its immediate death in the ocean? Or does it say, you know, look, like I'm a different species, I got my own troubles, you know, I got bureaucracy to develop over here, I've got technologies, and you know, which way is it gonna go? So Manu bends down, picks up the little fish, takes it home, puts it in a jar, begins to feed it. As soon as he feeds it and cares for it, it grows quite a bit bigger. He has to move it into a tank. He feeds it again, it grows bigger again. He has to put it in a pond. Soon it grows the pond, and now he has to put it in the lake. Pretty soon it's too big for the lake, so he has to pick it up and carry all the way back to the ocean. It's the only thing that can hold it. And he notices that no matter how big it gets, it never gets heavy. It remains light. So he takes the huge fish now that was once a little fish, endangered species, and puts it back into the ocean. And the big fish swims in the ocean and turns around and says, I want to give you a little advice. There's a big flood coming. My advice, build a ship. And so then off goes the fish. So, you know, so Manu starts designing ships, you know, builds a big ship. Sure enough, torrential rains come. And as soon as the rains come, the big fish comes back. Takes the ship that Manu has made and ties it, happens to have a horn, the fish, ties it to its horn, and it pulls it through the raging seas of the storms of the deluge and pulls it to the highest point on earth, Mount Meru, which turns out to be the original cathedral. The original temple was actually a mountain, and all of these churches and temples are formed in that image. Ties it, the ship to that, and explains to Manu, here are certain practices you need to do. If you do these practices, you will join creation and help it to continue. So he teaches the first spiritual practices to Manu, man who had bent down to help that little fish. And now it is a great fish. And then out of the fish comes Vishnu, the god of creation, to reveal the fact that in bending to the little fish, he had actually picked up the god of creation. And he had been given assistance to the god, the deity that dreamed up the world by bending down to something asking to help nearby. And so from there on, life goes on. So I love this story. It has great stuff in it. Like, we don't have to go get a big project, you know, and figure out necessarily how to do some great thing and convince everybody through the internet, you know, this is the way to do it, you know, join my nonprofit internet, world-saving, planet-saving, you know, I mean, you can do it, but, you know, it's called mania. But anyway, what I think the story is trying to say is nearby there is some small thing calling for our attention, saying that it will be swallowed if we don't bend down to it and pick it up. And back to that Irish idea, if each person would have bent down to the thing nearby that's saying, please help me or I'll get swallowed by this tornado of a world, then all of a sudden everybody would be picking up these little things, and then they become bigger things of their own accord. And if we pick up the right thing, it doesn't become too heavy for us. Actually, no matter how big it gets, it's still light to us because we are in the right relationship to it. You get what I'm saying? And then, of course, you notice physics has figured the same thing out. The butterfly effect and all that. A little change over here can sometimes change everything. And I think we're in that dynamic. That's the creative dynamic. So I use that story to show that relationship and then try to say something clever about it. See if it's clever now. It's important to know about the system through which small can change big things, especially when the floods of change come and everything familiar seems about to be washed away. At certain times in the great back and forth of the tides of creation and destruction, nature needs a little helping hand, and culture needs to return to practices that assist the continuing song of creation. Mano represents the sense that when a person becomes truly big, they can learn to bow to something other than simple self-interest and can serve something beyond themselves. Humanity, if it awakens more fully to the creative ancestral prototype that sleeps within us, can act contra naturam and go against blind needs and unconscious selfish greed. Humanity remains capable of bending to the earth again and learning to assist the little fish of creation to find some refuge and ways to survive the great changes already underway. Helping the other, it turns out, secretly helps oneself. The act of genuinely serving something beyond and seemingly below oneself can have a hidden benefit. Saving that which seems helpless redeems the redeemer as well. A little help can be repaid tenfold. Of course, if the help is offered in hopes of a great return, all bets are off. You know that sneaky little one, you know? A lot of churches operate on that principle. I'll do a good deed now because I'll get my reward in heaven. You know, they didn't read the small print that says whatever you find here, you find there. You get what I'm saying? There is no greater reward there than what a person finds here. It's in the small print. It may be human nature to make a deal in hopes of getting a good return, but it is contra naturam, against nature, our nature, to sacrifice one's personal comfort and desires in order to redeem something in greater need than ourselves. Each person has a little self, an ego self that formed early on and presents itself as the true self on most occasions. The ego self always has some falseness in it because it formed partially to keep us from being devoured by life. The little self is necessary. Even great Vishnu had to enter the world in the form of a little fish. Eventually, though, a person must ask for help and become a swimmer in the greater and greater containers of life. It's the inner self, the deep self, that has the capacity to grow larger and larger with genuine knowledge and with practices that connect to the hidden forces of the world. So I'm now turning the human into the fish growing bigger and bigger. And there's a cute little story in here from the Hasidic tradition where someone goes to the great rabbi and says, Rabbi, why is it that no one sees God anymore? And rabbi says, because they're not willing to bend down far enough. You know what I'm saying? As people are making these great, you know, pretensions of the divine up here, the divine, like that little fish, is Vishnu, hidden down there, waiting for us to bend. The bowing is the natural pose of gratitude, the natural way of staying connected to the earth and therefore to our own deep inner soul nature. And so, to me, that's a great story of how to be in the world and how to help something because it asks for our help rather than pretend to save things that we don't even understand. I'm looking back there because I have no idea what time it is, which is usually my condition. Okay, thank you. I have a tendency to get caught in stories and go on and on with the stories. It doesn't hurt me at all, but people tell me they have relationships and job responsibilities. The bigger self has a deep trust in life, whereas the little self lives in fear of being overlooked or else in terror of being swallowed up. Mano bent down when asked for help and acted from that big self within. He found a sympathy that runs deep inside humanity, an age-old quality equal to the devouring realm of the fishes. The name in ancient Hindu philosophy for that which devours life, both in nature and in culture, is the realm of the fishes. In other words, we live in the realm of the fishes, where the big eats the small. Where, you know what I'm saying? Where the corporations devour the lives of people and the lives of animals. Big eats small in culture. It happens in untold magnitude in the seas of the world. While we're sitting here, uncountable numbers of little fish and plankton are being swallowed by bigger fish. It's the generator of life and death in this world, the exchange between the big forces and the little, constantly ongoing. And inside culture, it manifests as well. You watch it now in political stuff going on. China, why is China such a big deal now? Because it's so big. It's just so big. It can eat all kinds of little fish. It can devour all kinds of energy as well as all kinds of products and so on and so forth. What I called in here contra naturam, sometimes nature goes against itself and the small, like the little fish of Vishnu, becomes the big thing. We have to count on that part of nature now and we have to find that part in our own nature. I'll extend it one more way. That is to say that in order to grow at certain times in our life, we have to go against our own usual pattern. That one of the hardest things is to move the patterns of the ego out of the way in order to spread the deep self out into a bigger form. When a person can live closer to the deep self, what happens is they become, I guess you could call it more balanced, but I mean a dynamic balance. And when a person is able to do that, it's not just to their own benefit, it's to the benefit of the people around them. Carl Jung, towards the end when he was getting older, called it the gradient in a person's life. That when a person gets near the places where they're supposed to bend down, the places where they can really give creative assistance to the world, the places where they're close to the gold inside themselves, when that's happening to a person, it seems almost automatically that good things occur or beneficial things occur, but not just for them, it flows from them out to those around them. So it's a way of saying the idea isn't to heroically make these big changes, but to make the changes inside one's own life, which then have a subtle effect even on our neighbors. Does this make sense? And so I'll just say it out loud because I don't know what else to do. According to all the old stories, there is something inside each person. I call it the deep self. You could call it the ancient soul that's already in there. It doesn't have to be purchased. It doesn't. You don't have to send away, you know, to eBay. It doesn't require a training course exactly. It requires that it be incited and revealed to oneself. And when that deep self occurs, a person is in the center of life and secretly near the tree of life at the center. In the midst of the worst hour, if it's possible for a person to simply breathe, this is what a lot of meditation and even yoga practice is about, to breathe in such a way that the breath is going all the way down into the body and catch the rhythm that actually the breath takes, the anxieties and the fears rather quickly disappear and suddenly vision comes back and a person can see a way to act and a way to go that's more genuine for them and actually more beneficial for everybody else. According to the mythic perspective, it's an axiom that if a person becomes a bigger version of themselves, a deeper expression of their natural self, it benefits everybody automatically. And so I just want to say that because I know it's hard to be in the world these days, and particularly hard for young people to stand in the storms of the world right now and have some sense that there's a stability within. Because the world outside is not going to settle down. it's going to continue to rattle. It's going to continue to shake because of this business of being in the lifting of the veil period. A lot of things still have to get uncovered. A lot of things still have to get torn apart. And in the midst of that, other things will be discovered and found. In the meantime, what I usually get intrigued with is the arts and practices that allow a person to maintain some contact to the natural, deep inner self. And so there's not time tonight to go on to that, but I hope you get that idea. And to me, it's very important. I say it to myself all the time. I try to breathe towards it. There is a deep self inside from the beginning that already knows what it is we're trying to find out. And according to Native traditions here in North America and in South America, it has what's called medicine. That is to say, each person that enters the world is carrying medicine, a unique medicine that first of all can heal our own wounds and then can be offered to some degree to other people. That each person is actually a medicine carrier. And to me, that's a more valuable piece of information than knowing that someday you might get a national insurance health card. You get what I'm saying? I'm all for, like, whatever it is, insurance or health or anything anybody can purchase, but it's really not what we're looking for. I think what we're looking for is our own medicine. The last story in the book is about how people first found medicine, and interestingly enough, it's like the Irish story. People found medicine when they stood and looked into the dark, and then the one who created the world gave them the first piece of knowledge about medicine. And so that's another way to understand, I think, what's going on. We're secretly here in a quest for medicine, finding the medicine we carry and learning ways to give and to help sustain the medicine in the world. Medicine in this case doesn't mean drugs. It means the natural gifts that people have. And according to all the old stories, everybody who is born into the world is born with medicine. And this is a time when that medicine is needed much more, in my opinion, than a national health plan, even though, you know, vote for that. It's cool. It's better than having nothing. But it's really the deep medicine we're looking for, not just a distribution network for drugs. So I'm going to stop there before going to a poem. And just anybody want to say something or ask something or scream, whatever you might need or want. You're very welcome. And we'll end singing too, because it's very stylish. And we don't know. We might not have another chance for a while to sing, you know how it gets. So I'll repeat the kind of general idea that I'm trying to suggest and now trying to write about, that what allows the world and helps the world to continue are these two stories. The big story, of the cosmos. I have a chapter called Cosm and Chasm, the cosmos and the chaos, and how the two go back and forth. And that's the big story. And then the corresponding thing, which is its opposite and yet somehow it's equal, the exact story living through each person. And the old rule was, you know, after we die, and I hope everybody has heard that so far no one's gotten out of this alive. You know what I'm saying? That life turns out to be fatal. Everybody who's ever gotten it has died. And so, you know, more or less that's on its way, or we're on its way to it. You know, the African proverb is, on the road that leads to your death, your legs will carry you and your feet will go. There's no way to avoid it. And if we try to avoid it, we run into the lions and get devoured all the sooner. So that's the basic story. And so, but the other part of the story is that each person goes from the door of birth to the door of death in a completely unique way. Many more people will come, I hope, down the pike, as they say. But no one will ever come down with the strange twist of fate that inhabits each one of us. No one will come with the odd, you know, idiosyncratic way of living out a story that each of us will do. So it's not that we have to measure up to something that someone else saw. and not that we have to kind of validate some kind of something that's not natural to us. More importantly, we have to find, you could call it the inner pattern. There's another little story in the book where after a soul, a person dies, the body goes into the earth, the soul continues. And the old woman of the world is sitting out in front of her cave. To her, it's like a mansion, but it looks like a cave. And she sees one of the children of the earth coming. She's the old woman of the world. She recognizes that soul. And so she takes a stick and draws the design of that soul on the ground, the pattern that was inside its life. She draws half of it in the earth. And then the soul has to come up and fill in the other half of the pattern. And the only way the soul can know how to fill in the pattern is it has lived its own life and found the pattern. If the soul fills it in, then they go into the cave and go meet with the ancestors. And apparently the ancestors are having like this great party, you know, in the world behind the world. And they really know how to party down. And so if you can get the pattern, you get to party with the ancestors, you know. That's a real celebration. And then if you don't, don't feel bad about it. You just go back and start over again. You know what I'm saying? Which some people like that. In other words, who is it that said, this life is too interesting to live it only once? That there's something about the soul that wants to come back into the world. And so that happens automatically in some cases, but then it's important also to know that in the Mahayana, which is what it's called in Tibetan practices and so on, or the Great Way, what happens is those who are most realized, who have found enlightenment, decide consciously of their own accord to come back into the world to help others find their way. So that there's something in the soul that wants to come back anyway. Or as they used to say, eternity is in love with the productions of time. The gods are envious of us. We heard it in the story. The gods are jealous of humanity because humanity gets to live it in a heartfelt, broken-hearted, open-hearted way. Because we are descended from the heart of heaven, but we live the whole thing flesh and blood. So it really is a gift of particular life that each one of us has, according to the old stories. And I'm sticking with them. So this is a little poem. I have a section in the book about dancing. You know, not exactly hip-hop, but about how the soul dances its way through life. And this is a poem called Advice. It's from the Bill Holm, who's like a Icelandic kind of descendant who lives in Minnesota. And plays piano and writes great poems. And this is called, his poem called Advice. Someone dancing inside us learned only a few steps. The do you work in 4/4 time and the what did you expect waltz. Pretty cool kind of dry Scandinavian wit, you know. He hasn't noticed yet. The woman standing away from the lamp, the one with black eyes who knows the rumba and strange steps in jumpy rhythms from the mountains of Bulgaria. If they dance together, something unexpected will happen. And if they don't, then the next world will be just like this one. So the idea is to dance with the woman away from the lamp, or the man away from the lamp, or whoever has these intonations of the vibrations from the mountains of Bulgaria. You know what I mean? The idea is enter the dance and do it in some open-hearted way, and that even if it's painful and even if it's confusing, it's actually contributing to the next world being better than this one. That's my thought. All right, so we asked the ancestors to come in and help us out. And I think they're getting ready to go. So we want to say thank you. Thanks for the gift of being here tonight, for the chance to dwell inside stories and consider the world behind the world. And thanks for whatever insight may have come into the room. And so we'll sing the same song. And it works as an exit song as well. You know, thank you for the guidance of the female ancestors and the male ancestors. And There's a few tricks with this kind of song. You can send it out in front of you so that when you're going down the road, you catch back up with it. That's one trick you can do. And then the other thing is you can send it to anybody you know who might be in trouble. One of the old traditions is not to just make a prayer or a song for oneself, but to think of others in the world, like the little fish that Manu picked up. And so you can send this to anyone in the world you're concerned about. And as I like to say, there are no roaming charges. You know what I'm saying? It can go anywhere. The song is so old, it gets bypasses T-Mobile and everything. It gets right to where you want it to go.
What up?